The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, clinical psychologist Ian Robertson talked to me about confidence, what it is, how you can get more of it, and the trouble with too much of it. Cork native Megan Cusack told me about her role as Irish nurse Nancy Corrigan in the hugely popular TV drama Call the Midwife. Director of the National Ambulance Service Martin Dunn joined me in studio ahead of his retirement to look back on the great work carried out during the early days of the COVID crisis, as well as the ongoing tireless efforts of the NAS. And author Julian Sancton's marvellous debut book, Madhouse at the End of the Earth, tells the true survival story of an early polar expedition that went terribly awry. And he spoke to me about the plight of the Belgica. That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy. At 9.26, Ian Robertson is interested in how the brain works. He's a clinical psychologist and neuroscientist, and his latest book, How Confidence Works, gives us an intriguing insight on why we need confidence to get through life, what it is, how you can get more of it, and the trouble with too much of it. And what a pleasure it is to welcome in real life and glorious Technicolor in studio. Ian, nice to see you.
It's great to see you, Ryan. You do exist.
Not just a radio in the kitchen, you know. How have you been, by the way? Is life good? You look really well.
Privileged, you know, living in a lovely part of the world with, you know, close to family. So I know it's not like that for a lot of people. I've just been one of the lucky ones
sure.
in lockdown. Yeah.
And did you write this book in lockdown?
I did. And, you know, no better way of not having to travel, not having to, you know, there's some benefits of this. I used to travel a lot and I haven't travelled in the last year and a half, so much more time to do that.
Put your head down and concentrate on the subject at hand, which is confidence. And I think that, you know, I mentioned a little bit earlier on, Ian, that a lot of people's confidence has taken a hit with the lockdown. And a lot of people have regressed.
Yeah.
A lot of people are kind of, and even confident people I know are putting their toe into the water of society again with a certain reluctance. I mean, they're not, I thought they were going to rush headlong into the roaring 20s. They're kind of walking in gently.
Yeah. We're creatures of habit, Ryan.
Sure.
And I can remember what it was like, you know, the night before you went back to school after the long summer holidays.
Yeah.
You know, a wee bit of butterflies in the stomach.
Yes.
And because you've been doing something different. And, you know, but of course, once you're a day or two back into it and you're fine. But particularly for people who are a wee bit anxious or are not big extroverts, maybe who have been doing their college course online for a year, who have never... There's big challenges for millions of people, really, in getting back into things. Because confidence... The trouble with the great thing about confidence is it's like a fuel additive, that it accelerates its effects, because a little bit of extra confidence makes you do a little bit more. That expands your experiences and your successes, and that multiplies over time, and that happens over a lifetime with people.
Yes.
That's why two kids with exactly the same abilities, one with a tiny bit more confidence at the beginning, that tiny difference exponentially grows and creates a much more yawning gap with time, because confidence creates new opportunities, new experiences, new skills, etc. Whereas if you hold back, you don't get that opportunity.
Does your background, class, race, wealth affect confidence, or are you born with it? I mean,
it's mainly these things.
Is that right? Yeah.
It's mainly, but it's not only that. Bear with me, give 30 seconds of the study.
No.
Several thousand twins in the UK, okay? So twins, by definition, each have the same socioeconomic background.
Yeah, sure.
They got them to self-rate their socioeconomic state, their social ladder. Where do you stand on the social ladder? 1 to 10. Most of us can rate ourselves on that. And what they found was that until adolescence, these kids were more or less the same in their self-ratings. But then, for some reason, some of the twins started to rate themselves as lower social status compared to the other twin. Mm. And when they did that, their opportunities declined, their educational attainment declined, their drug use, they were more likely to use drugs, more likely to end up in trouble. So, this, and we don't understand what happened. Something happened in their adolescence that they started to perceive themselves to be of lower social status than their twin.
But this is why your book was so interesting. Like you talk about, at one stage, elite athletes or indeed people who are just high achievers.
Yeah.
And like all great psychology and psychiatry, you kind of have to go back to their childhood to say what has driven them to become something a little more other than everyone else.
That's right. And it seems to be that super elite athletes, I mean,
the Tiger Woods of this world,
it seems to be that super athletes have most of them have had a tough experience in their early life. You know, I mean, parents divorce or something like that. And then what they then have is some example. They meet an Olympian. They meet someone who's inspiring in whatever the domain they're wanting to excel in. And then they have some early success experience, maybe an amateur win or something like that.
Yes.
And that kind of seems to create a recipe for really driven people who really go to the top. Now, so Tiger Woods, for example, he had a terrible stutter as a child and he was really bullied at school. He was really miserable. And then he won the American Amateur Golf Championship at a very young age. And that incredible drive, I mean, no one has won as many, I don't think, or one other golfer has won as many tournaments as he's won. Now, poor guy now is in a different state. But so that's true not just of Tiger Woods, but in general, you seem to have this adversity earlier in your life that then drives you. And that's true of prime ministers of the UK and presidents of the US. Many of them are orphans. Many of them are come from single parent families. And it seems to be there's something about early.
Well, Bill Clinton would be a prime example of that. It came from a very poor background, but also, again, single mother to an extent.
Exactly. And you know, and Barack Obama had a tough enough, you know, life as well growing up.
Yeah.
So that seems to be that. And, you know, one of the greatest sources of confidence is mastering adversity, is getting through tough times. Because what you do there is you learn that you are not your emotions. You learn that anxiety passes. You learn that, yes, you can be low mood, you can be down, but eventually it goes.
Great.
And you learn, and if you feel anxious, so I'm thinking of the people who are, you know, maybe anxious about going into college or going back to college having never been there. If they can just take the step, just do it in spite of feeling anxious. And this is true of going out socially and things like that.
Yeah.
If you do things in spite of anxiety and you keep doing them, getting through the anxiety, that will build your confidence like few other things.
It's like you mentioned Sonia Sullivan. I know it's all the sporting industry, but Sonia Sullivan, who needed to kind of break back into the elite again, having suffered a defeat. She could have gone home and said, that's the end of that. But she went incrementally. That's the way you're just describing it there.
Exactly. She's a great woman.
Yeah.
And she had this very humiliating, you know, public failure in the Olympics, you know, where the expectations were so high for her. And she went back to London and she just forgot about Olympics, forgot about medals, and just said, okay, what's my target for Saturday's road race?
Softly again,
And that's the thing about confidence. The main thing about confidence is it makes you do stuff.
Yes.
It helps you do stuff. And if you do stuff, you'll get success experiences. If you have small success experiences, will change the chemistry of your brain. They will release dopamine in the brain's reward network, which is a natural antidepressant and a natural anti-anxiety drug. So if you can just, confidence makes you do stuff. If you can just get through stuff and do them, that will build up confidence. And once you have that, then you can, that will multiply itself. Success leads to success.
Okay. And there is a difference though, isn't there, between the person who's confident and can back it up with a certain emotional, intellectual ability versus, excuse the language, but a bullshit artist.
Yeah.
Who's like this, like is it Ally McLeod?
Yes.
Right. So describe, compare and contrast those two, those two schools of confidence.
Yeah, Ali McLeod, of course, was he was the Scotland team manager, who
he's part of column B in this example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he so Scotland had unusually qualified for the World Cup in Argentina, and he created the kind of national delusion because everyone seemed to buy into. He created this fantasy bubble, and he was asked, for instance, what are you going to do when Scotland wins the World Cup? As he had said, he says, win it again.
A spoof.
It was the most, and so that kind of bubble, that was a kind of farcical bubble of overconfidence, but it shows you that confidence is enormously contagious.
Yeah.
And it's contagious because it buys you status, because it lifts people's mood, and that's the source of.
But it's a debased currency, is it not? If it's not delivered upon.
Well, yes, it is.
But like, it's finite then.
But the problem is, it buys you so much in the short and medium term.
Is that enough?
That it can be self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
So Adam Newman, who created the WeWork, for instance, I mean, so based on the most inflated overconfidence, he was going to cure, stop world wars and stop orphans existing in the world. But he ended up with a multi-billion company valuation. Yeah. And when it finally, the valuation failed, he went out with a huge packet. And so, I mean, with billions of payoff. And so that's the trouble with overconfidence.
Yeah. You know, in Line of Duty recently, as you're talking like that, there was a great discovery of somebody did something bad. I'm worried about giving too much away. But the line that was so good in it was an example of somebody failing upwards. Up the ladder, getting promoted and promoted.
Yeah.
But sometimes they were getting promoted to get them out of the way.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're getting promoted because they were stuck for somebody to put in the job. But either way, they were just eminently unqualified for the job. But this kind of, the confidence of the mediocre middle guy who just drifts up the ladder. You go, but that's a strange type of confidence,
well,
isn't
well,
it?
No, but generally, overconfidence will, in a standard interview panel where your actual abilities are not technically tested, will get you the job more likely than if you're less confident.
That's terribly unfair.
It's unfair, it doesn't make you any better on job. In fact, as you were saying there, it makes you worse the job.
Yeah.
And this penalises women enormously.
Women,
because women on average have less overconfidence than men.
Why?
They're much. So if you give a group of male and female students a geography test, okay, and you get, and so the men say get 7 out of 10 and the women maybe get 7.5 out of 10, and then you say, what scores do you think you got on the test? The men will say 8.5 and the women will say 6.5.
And sure enough, then the results will show.
No, but actually the women have been slightly better.
Yeah.
But they've underrated them.
Themselves,
but the women then are less likely to volunteer to take part in a further national competition, to take part in a general knowledge competition. Because they're more realistic in their self-appraisal of their abilities, they don't get the same benefits of the bullshitting, forgive the term.
No, it's a good term for the day that's in it.
Yeah.
So why is there a gender imbalance with regards to confidence? Is that because society has built that up, or is it a more basic?
It's largely society.
It's societal.
Built it
okay,
up.
So that
and,
needs
and
to
you
be...
know, for instance, women who are bigger and women who feel more physically formidable are more confident than women who are smaller or less. It's as primitive as that.
Yeah.
It started, tens of thousands of years ago, men, when muscles were the main thing.
Big man, big confidence.
Man. And so the whole history of beating up women, that kind of physical, basic primitive physical strength has led to women having to adapt to these primitive imbalances and dominance. It is, but we live in a civilization now where these Darwinian principles are no longer relevant.
Yeah.
And actually, we need more women in senior positions because they're less vulnerable to the addictive and distorting effects of overconfidence and power addiction.
Yeah. Yeah, until that is that imbalance is corrected.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think the world will be very
safe. No, no, it won't. It won't. It won't.
How are we in terms of confidence of a race, you know, national confidence?
Yes.
So, for example, just as you were talking there, I was thinking, you know, whenever I say to my girls, I say to my daughters, obviously, I'll say, you know, you look beautiful today. And no, I don't. I said, well, hang on a second. We're going to correct this at from the get-go. You're an Irish woman. You're going to say thank you.
Yeah.
You're not
yeah.
going to say no, yeah. I don't. Right? Yeah. So do you know what I mean? This is a micro example of what should be a national thing. Because in Ireland, we tend to kowtow a little bit and we kind of bump into somebody. We say, sorry. We don't say, excuse me. You know, it's a strange thing.
It's so interesting you say that, because there actually is an objective measure of bullshitting, which is you in the PISA study of ability across OECD countries.
Mm.
They say, how familiar are you with these mathematical terms from zero, never heard of them, to 10, understand it completely and know it? And they insert five fictitious terms that don't exist in it. And so you get the actual measure of how bullshitty a culture is. And sure enough, which are the most bullshitty countries?
Yeah.
America and Canada. Which are the least bullshitty countries? Well, Scotland's at the very lowest. Ireland's pretty low as well. But you're right. We have this tendency to self-deprecate, to apologise in advance, and seek reassurance. Oh, am I talking rubbish? The trouble with that kind of reassurance seeking and constant self-deprecation, it does actually... the words you say to yourself are important, and it does eat into your confidence.
Yes.
And what's more, it communicates that to the other person. So if you don't appear confident in yourself, why should the other person be confident in you? So we have to be careful we don't fall into the habit of constantly undercutting ourselves, constantly seeking reassurance. You know, this is probably rubbish. Oh, I look terrible today. Sorry, it's such a mess. So all this kind of stuff.
Just look up a bit more.
Yeah, and the posture is important as well.
Yeah, the shoulders have to be out of it, but without being a strut, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Without being a strut. I mean, the kind of power pose research hasn't panned out as being validated. But what has panned out is if you constrict your body position.
Yes.
So you know what it's like, you know, students coming into a professor's, they'll tend to make themselves smaller. We tend to make ourselves smaller with more dominant people. Women, maybe a little more than men, unconsciously. When you do that, that does undercut your confidence.
There's a story about Marilyn Monroe walking along midtown Manhattan with a friend, and the friend said, she was wearing a hat and a scarf, and the friend said, how come you're not being stopped by anyone? Like, you're Marilyn Monroe. And she said, well, obviously, I'm in kind of disguise. She said, do you want to see what it's like being Marilyn Monroe? And the guy said, yes, please. She took the hat off, the scarf. She put the hair left and right, and she put the lipstick on, and she walked down the street. She couldn't move for half a sec. Confidence of appearance.
Yeah, yeah,
And I talk about national confidence. If you've got national confidence versus patriotism versus national pride.
Yeah.
And they're all kind of, that can be a dangerous combination too, if you look at the history of time. Or in your book, Ian, you talk about Kennedy's aspirations to the moon. Yeah. That is a beautiful confidence, because it's scientific and it's national and it's aspirational. And if you're a citizen of a country that has such lofty aspirations, that confidence can be contagious.
It is. And you know what? Ireland came through the biggest drop in the standard of living in the Great Recession, the 2008 recession.
Yeah.
And I was so proud to be, I'm an Irish citizen, have been for 20 years. I was so proud to be part of the sheer grit. I know there was a huge amount of pain and suffering, I know that. But the huge grit that people showed in getting through that. And I think that experience of toughing it through the whole troika and all that, has meant that that's one of the reasons we've had a pretty mature response to COVID.
Yes, okay, interesting.
Yeah. And I think that that kind of sense of collective confidence, because collective confidence is more than the sum of the individual confidences.
Sure.
We can be self-deprecating as individuals, but as a group, we believe that the as a nation, we feel confident. And that is absolutely true. And that will multiply, that will affect our economy. That will affect our well-being, because one of the great antidotes to anxiety and poor mental health is confidence.
Yes.
It's very difficult to feel confident if you don't feel in control of your emotions, and vice versa. So
That comes with the territory. And I just see we are coming down with comments and questions. We could be here for about 2 days, which is for reflection of the interest in the subject. Yeah. And that's why people would be able to pick up your book after they've heard the interview today. Venture capitalists, I mean, you write that they're often more interested in entrepreneurs that have had previously failed ventures.
Yes, that's right.
Now, venture capitalists have... a mixed response in countries like this or in times like these. But tell me a little about that.
Yeah, well, it's the scars on your back. It's one of the problems. How you deal with failure is one of the great sources of confidence. Because, and this happens to kids at school, for instance, who, if they fail an exam, they can sometimes, that can become a fixed mindset about themselves.
Yes.
And if you had, respond to failure by saying, look, this is actually an opportunity for me to learn how not to fail in future. That literally allows the frontal lobes of your brain to open up to process the information and make it more likely that you will learn something from this so that you will not fail in future. That's one reason the venture capitalists like the people, because they've been forced to learn from the mistakes. Mm-hmm. But it's really important that you believe you can change. The worst thing is to have a fixed mindset about your abilities.
Yeah.
I'm just not an entrepreneur. I'm just no good. I can't play music. I'm just no good academically. These kind of fixed mindsets sabotage your ability to use confidence.
You're your own
to climb
worst
back.
Enemy.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, why do people go red even if they're confident? I don't know if that's a question you can answer.
Well, I mean, blushing, some people blush more than others. Yeah. It's a conditioned habit that's part of the sympathetic autonomic nervous system responding to challenge or stress. So that doesn't necessarily have to go with the thoughts you have inside your mind, because confidence is essentially the thoughts you have.
Okay, yeah. Question for Ian from Margaret. Does confidence need to be topped up at regular intervals in order to maintain your level of confidence? This question is coming from a person who was a very shy twin. They were back to growing up. But when I went to college, I came out of myself. However, I find that if I'm not putting myself out there constantly, I feel my confidence decreasing.
That's interesting. Yeah, we have different temperaments. Some of us are more outgoing than others temperamentally. But we're also creatures of habit. So if we're in the habit of putting ourselves out there and getting mixing, that habit will maintain itself. But if you don't top up the habit, as Margaret says, if you don't top it up, then yes, our temperament can come through and we can revert. And that's happened to a lot of people in COVID.
Yes.
You know, a lot of people who temperamentally are maybe not terribly outgoing, a bit anxious, they need to really muster their confidence to get out there and to top up these habits that they maybe had beforehand.
Perfect. My husband always commands, says Barbara in Glasnevin, always commands more attention when he repeats what I have just said.
That's great. That is great.
Oh. I mean, but he's basically magpieing her as well.
Oh, I know. But, you know, and men, and I do not
terrible.
Accept, I do not accept myself
Go
for
on.
This. Men are the relationship between men and women, the degree to which men consciously and unconsciously undercut their women's confidence is just, it's formidable. And there's so many ways it happens.
Okay. Well, I won't necessarily agree with you. No. Which in itself, I think, answers the question.
Yeah,
all right. Jennifer was saying, brilliant discussion of how confidence impacts our lives. Women are penalized by lack of confidence more than men. Self-appraisal of confidence has a gender bias, it seems. Sean says, can someone overcompensate and become way more confident in their business life and then have zero confidence in their personal life?
Yeah, they can indeed, because confidence isn't a general feeling good about yourself. That's self-esteem, and that's different. Self-esteem doesn't get you success in life the way confidence does. Confidence is linked to specific action. So you can be confident in the sports field and very unconfident in the nightclub, for instance.
Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely. And that's why you have to build confidence in specific domains through doing stuff and getting the success experiences that help change the chemistry of your brain to build more confidence.
That's it. And even doing this show, I would display a different level of what you might call confidence, whatever.
Yeah.
But if you were to meet me walking out in the park or something, I'm much more...
Exactly.
This is more of a...
This is your mental uniform you wear.
Oh, thank
you're
you.
in your uniform.
That's a great way
you can
of
do
putting
things
it.
With you. Yeah, that's right.
So you'd be a bit more low key and say, nice to meet you, whatever, which we wouldn't be saying, good morning. Did I tell you what I just read last night? It's really interesting. How are you? Just call me, oh, your man's a pain in the neck. All right. As an educator, like many of my colleagues, I find it's not the case. For example, Generation Z millennials do not have confidence. The opposite is true. Misplaced sense of confidence, little supporting their confident beliefs in their own ability in assignment work. Very worrying is that they can border on delusion, a fixed, firm, false belief. Would Dr. Robinson argue confidence only exists where there is a firm foundation for claims made?
Well, you know what? We always have to push ourselves beyond what we're absolutely certain we can do. That's what confidence is. So you always have to fake it a little bit.
Yeah. Well,
you always do something before you're quite ready. Mm. Okay. Perfectionism is the enemy of confidence because you'll never allow yourself to be. So in a sense, yes, perhaps, but no, you can't always be 100% certain. You have to just make that leap sometimes, a little bit of a leap.
Take the leap, take the chance. Yeah. Can you discuss how women's confidence can be knocked once they enter motherhood, on how their whole world flips upside down, and how when a woman returns to the corporate world after maternity leave, she can be told in year-end appraisals she has received a below expectation because she was out for half the year on maternity leave? What does Ian think about performance ratings in the private sector and how grade affects confidence? Also, I'd love to hear more discussion on confidence in women in the workforce and how to build up their confidence while returning back from maternity leave.
So. Yeah, that's a. I've seen colleagues returning from maternity leave, and I've seen just that how lacking in confidence they are. It's like, but it's a similar to what happens with the school holidays coming back. That kind of nervousness in school holidays. But the fact is that there are systematic biases happening, unconscious among their male colleagues, who don't properly give them credit for the fact that they've been off, producing children for the country.
Yes, yes, which is a job in itself. Yeah. Regarding confidence in Monsters Inc., Mike, the smaller guy, and Sully, the larger one, show how nature compensated by giving smaller creatures increased confidence. Think how small dogs take charge over large dogs despite size difference. It's nature's way of compensating for a lack in other areas. And of course, I was only thinking about this the other day. If you take it like the Lion King, it's Pumbaa and Timon. Yeah. And in Of Mice and Men, you've got the big guy and the little guy, which I always think is a similar thing. But I don't know if there's too much to read into that. I want to ask, I'm a super efficient, that's Kieran in Glasnevin, a very efficient, confident man. I only have limited education, but got an amazing upbringing. My father always drummed punctuality, discipline, etc. into me. And I expect the same from everyone else. Am I just being impatient or is this a good thing to be?
Look, absolutely. You know, if you've had a... Having a good education is a huge advantage for confidence. If you have people who manage in spite of the things that would normally subtract from your confidence, if you manage to, through self-pride and self-discipline, to do that, that's a brilliant thing to do, to have that kind of self-concept and not be dragged down by a feeling of, oh, I didn't have much of an education, therefore, and to feel your social status is lower because of that.
Yes.
You know, to ignore these things, none of them are inevitable, none of them are unchangeable. For you to do what this chap says is absolutely the correct thing to do.
Your book is not only does it offer these lovely sporting and historical snapshots and their effect on confidence, but also it offers a broader manual for life. And I think it's a fascinating read and will be a welcome addition to anyone's shelf in any country, but especially in Ireland, where confidence it needs to be discussed a little more. Ian, congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
Really good to. I think you're my first guest in the radio studio, I think, in a year or thereabouts. But either way, it's great to see you but particularly nice to start the return of human beings in the radio studio with me today with you. So go well and thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
Good to see you as always. The book, the name of it is How Confidence Works. It's by Ian Robertson, published by Bantam Press. Available for pre-order at your local bookshop now, and it'll be out on the 3rd of June. So be sure to pre-order that. And as I say, then 3rd of June, head down to your local bookshop and pick up a copy. You will not be disappointed. Ian, thanks again.
Thanks, Ryan.
Back shortly. At 9:27 this Tuesday morning, very good to have your company. Let's say good morning to Megan Cusack. Hello, Megan.
Hi there, how are you doing?
Nice to talk to you. How are you getting on today?
Yeah, not too bad. I mean, this is a bit this is a bit mental, isn't it?
No, well, it's just
chant to you, Ryan, an Irish superstar at, you know, 9:30 on a Tuesday morning.
Listen, the only superstar in this conversation is on a phone line from the UK. congratulations on your latest role. Would you do me a favour, Megan?
Yeah, of course.
What is Call the Midwife? Like, what is it? Why is it?
Why is it?
Because I'm just saying, 8 million people watch this programme in the UK on a Sunday. So will you, and you're in it, and you're brilliant in it. So tell us what it is.
I know, 8 million people. I try not to think about that factor, because that's a bit nerve-wracking. but, I mean, it's a fab show, kind of set, started in the 1950s. Now it's, you know, we're now in 1966 with it. And it kind of, it tells the stories of midwives and the nuns that work in there. And what life was like in East London. And, you know, it comes across as quite a wholesome show, but it's wonderful in the fact that it, you know, educates people at the same time. It brings up issues that were going on around then that, you know, you may not know about, which I think is what makes it really special.
Yeah, because it's a little deceptive there. You might think it's like Heartbeat or something. It's like cozy and lovely outfits and all the rest. And the next thing you know, it's gay conversion therapy. And you go, huh, where did that come from?
Exactly, yeah. Which was just recent. And that's only now been banned in the UK just last week. And, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know that. And it gets people Googling a lot of things and kind of learning a lot more.
Yeah. And you're in there as Nancy Corrigan, a kind of midwife pupil, and you're Irish. You're very much Irish in the role. Was it built for an Irish person, or did they go Irish when you arrived?
I think it was built for an Irish person. The character breakdown I got was she was Southern Irish. And I think then originally she possibly was going to be from Dublin, but then when I auditioned, they were like, "No, we'll just keep her from Cork."
yeah. Brought up by Irish nuns in Cork, no less.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and give us a kind of a rundown of where you were at in all of that, the storyline.
So, as in kind of her background?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so she was an orphan, and she originally kind of lived with her grandmother for a bit until she passed away, and then she ended up in an orphanage, kind of being raised by the nuns.
And to get into all, I mean, that's heavy stuff, but at the same time, they touch on these things, which is no harm at all. You had, going into this role, very long hair and no idea how to cycle a bike, and now look at you.
I know, cycling a bike, delivering babies on a Sunday evening, not expected, you know?
Your acting pedigree, everyone knows listening to this programme knows about the Cusacks. So will you give us a kind of rough outline, a sketch of your family tree?
Yeah. Well, so I'm fourth generation, along with a couple of my cousins. But of course, it started way back with my grandparents, Cyril and Maureen. Mm-hmm. Cyril was acting from a wee age because his parents went round kind of as a touring theatre when he was younger.
Yeah.
They came over from South Africa. And then, of course, he got all the sisters who then subsequently married actors as well. So, you know, there's just a couple of us.
Yeah.
A couple of us about the place.
So you have Niamh, Circa, Sinead, Catherine. And your parents are?
Porrig and Denise.
Okay, great. And then you have... Then you obviously grew up in Skibbereen in West Cork. When did you think, yeah, I want to go, I want to do what they do or they did?
I think I kind of always had that. Sure, I was putting on little plays with my friends when I was younger. So I think my parents sort of had the clue that it was a losing battle to try and get me to do anything else. Much to their disappointment, in the sense that they were like, be a plumber, hairdresser, carpenter. You're always in work, steady work. And I went, no, I'm gonna go into a life of possible rejection and no money.
And with school, were you one of those looking out the window, or were you up the front of the class?
Oh, definitely looking out the window. Absolutely head in the clouds. Wouldn't have a clue. If you asked me to go do any French or geography, no, useless.
It's hard. It's hard, isn't it? Like, for students like that who are brilliant people but not academic students.
Yeah, I was just talking about this with my cousin the other day, actually. You know, it's there are people who are so good at the academic side, and it's amazing, but it feels like they're always championed. And then you've got, you know, there were lads in my year that may not have been good with maths or science or anything, but you ask them to take apart a car and put it back together again, and they've no problem with that. And I feel like it's a shame that sometimes that gets looked over just because, you know, not they're not good at putting the essays together or, you know, getting the points in the exams, you know?
Yeah, that's the nature of the system here, I suppose. But I think it's kind of more fairer in the UK. They seem to kind of hone in on what you might be good at.
Yeah, I think there's kind of more options there here in the UK. You know, I talk to people who did exams in drama or photography because they have that college. You can go to college rather than sixth form. And, you know, I think, there's more areas to branch out in if you know what you want to do.
When I was in college 415 years ago, Megan, the head of the students' union was Richard Boyd Barrett.
No way.
Yeah, your cousin.
That is hilarious.
Yeah, he was. He was always. He had a megaphone in one hand, and a copy of the college paper in the other, whichever. But he was very articulate and eloquent, and there was no surprise that he would go on to do what he did. What he does. Do you follow him?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's amazing. And I remember him coming to see me in a show at the Abbey, and we were outside afterwards, and people coming up to him and just kind of shaking his hand and saying what an incredible person he was for, you know, speaking for the people and stuff like that. And to see that up close was really special.
And what about you? Are you getting a bit of that now? I mean, you're, 25 years old? You're on the cusp of greatness and now that you're... No, but you are, in fairness to you. You're on the road. And are you getting a little bit of that now? People come up to you saying, love what you do.
No one's come up to me in person, but I've had some really very lovely messages online from people. But, I mean, the show has such a following and it's like, and they're diehard fans. I was slightly unexpected. I really was, you know, people are making little videos and stuff like that, putting music in the background. And I'm there looking at this going, this is mental. What's going on here?
Well, Ellen from Wicklow is on by text to say, I absolutely love Call the Midwife. The show deals with important issues. Nancy's story is heartbreaking. Brilliant characters, and each episode gets better and better. So I know there's a fan base here. Now, you are of a generation, and when I meet people around your age group and you say, did you see that on the TV? They'll often say, I don't have a TV. But then I say, yeah, but did you watch it on your phone or your laptop? I say, yes, they do. So because you didn't actually physically have a television before you got this part. And I want to know, why? I mean, if you're an actor, surely you want to watch movies.
Yeah, I know. I think it's one of those things, we just never really got round to it.
Yeah.
Like, never got round to having a telly. But, you know, we'd all sit round and, you know, watch stuff on our laptop. And it's
exactly.
Much better having a telly now. You know, we don't have to crane our necks round.
So you got the big TV in, and did you watch yourself back? Are you okay watching yourself back? You're not watching behind through your fingers or anything?
Oh, yeah, absolutely watching through my fingers. It's horrible. It's a bizarre thing watching yourself. Because as well, you know, you film it so long ago that sometimes you forget what you've done. You're like, oh, yeah, there's that. That's coming. But yeah, no, we didn't have a TV. I don't think I would have watched it had it been for my two flatmates who made it real special, went out and got, you know, bubbles and flowers for the debut. My flatmate Keisha was like, I refuse to watch Megan's debut on a laptop.
Yeah.
So then the day of, on the Sunday... me and my other flatmate Joe, feeling ever so slightly worse for wear, made the trip to Curry's, which is a very, it's just overwhelming place in general. Yeah. Grabbed the TV and hopped on the bus back.
Yeah,
and had it set up just in time.
Yeah, I hear you on Curry's. I think one of the worst errors I ever made was going to IKEA with a hangover, and this day I regret it. I never forget. I actually just got triggered there. Thanks, Megan.
Yeah, it's a form of hell, I'd say.
I love listening to Megan Cusack. Loving this morning, says Cliona. I love the Cusack dynasty. I first knew of them when I went to see Cyril Cusack's, when I went to Cyril Cusack's funeral when I was about 10 or 11 with my mom, and then seeing Danny the Champion of the World with Jeremy Irons and Max Irons in it. One of my favourite Roald Dahl film adaptations, says Cliona. I'm delighted to see Megan now in Call the Midwife. So there's a person following every branch of the tree. That's great. it's great. So Call the Midwife, great social history of midwifery in the NHS since World War II. Wasn't clear from last Sunday's episode if Megan's character was going to stay in the show. Can you help us out, Megan?
Nancy will be returning.
There you go. That's good news.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. And what about anything else? I mean, I know you've great stage experience. Would you like to hit the West End in due course, or have you any further plans you can tell us about?
I mean, I love theatre. I think that's my kind of first love when it comes to acting. There's something so special about, you know, being in a room with a group of people for 4 weeks and then kind of creating a story together and then getting to put it on every night and go through the whole story every evening. Because you discover so much more every time you do it. Learn more about the character, find little nuances. Whereas with TV I've not done any film, but with TV, you know, you do it and then you have to move on and you're like, and then you're waking up at 3 a.m. going, why did I say that line like that? Why did I say that line like that?
Yeah.
And then you can't go back and kind of try it another way. Whereas with theatre, you get to keep working at it.
Mm.
I love it. I really do.
Helen was on to say, my mother trained as a midwife in London following her nursing training, and she adores Call the Midwife. She says it's so true to the time and brings back so many memories. Nancy's story for us is a great addition and wonderfully played, truly, says Helen about Megan Cusack, who is the latest addition to that wonderful dynasty. Megan, it's lovely to talk to you. I'm sure we'll meet in real life in due course. But until then, I wish you every success and happiness.
Thank you very much, Ryan. It's been lovely chatting with you.
Yeah, likewise. See you soon. See you in Curry's. That's Megan, Megan Cusack joining us there. And she is, as I say, starring as Nancy Corrigan. Lovely addition to the cast there in Call the Midwife, which returned to the BBC a few weeks ago. So we wish her well. It was very good of her to join us on the programme today. It's 9:39. Let me introduce you. We've come a long way, as we know, since the early days of COVID, which was back in March 2020, and there was a huge response. I remember so well to the COVID swab test demonstration that we did on the Late Late Show, and it was so new to everyone and so alien to everyone. We said we'd bring in the National Ambulance Service and show people what PPE looked like and what a swab looked like, and I was tested myself live on air in a way. We mocked it up, but it was just really to show people how it was done and not to be afraid. And this morning's guest in front of me, I'm delighted to say, is the man I spoke to on the night who's been working ever since with his wonderful staff behind the scenes. And his name is Martin Dunn, who is the director of the National Ambulance Service. Martin, welcome and nice to see you again.
Thanks very much, Ryan.
We've spoken a few times. Let's talk briefly about, we'll talk about you and your career in a moment, because you're bidding farewell to it all. But that night was memorable because it kind of was the start of the dawning of the realization that this thing got very real.
Yeah, I suppose it was great to get the opportunity because, as you say, we were dealing with a thing is probably a good way to put it, actually, Ryan, at the
not
time.
Not the scientific word. Yeah. Yeah.
And we weren't 100% sure what the thing was and what actually the thing was going to do and how the thing was going to spread.
Sure.
But, I mean, the HSE and all everyone else knew that something had to be done to start managing this. National Ambulance Service were probably front and centre because that's what we do. We respond to in emergency situations. And there was this probably level of fear across the country where people were genuinely 100% concerned as to what may or may not happen. And the processes were being put in place. And this term, we're going to have to swab people or test people to make sure that we can actually follow this COVID-19 or whatever it was at the time, to make sure we can track it and trace it and start fighting against it, right?
Yeah.
And there was this inherent fear as to what does this mean? What does this mean to me? How am I going to feel? What does it look like?
Yeah.
And I mean, we were mobilising teams and response cars, as you've seen that day, to go out to people's houses to start swabbing. And it was good. It was a good, I suppose, idea for us to be able to show people what it actually was,
yeah,
but also take the fear out of what people were afraid of,
yes,
which was the National Ambulance Service or other parts of the HSE community, whatever it was, going in to take a swab from them. What did it mean?
Yeah.
How did it work? And was it going to affect them in any negative way or positive way? Was it going to be sore? Let's be honest, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what was going to happen after? So you gave us that opportunity and we took it with gusto. Thanks very much.
It's by way of thanks to you, because you and your staff that night and your team and colleagues, you all had to readjust, I suppose, in some ways, for the public. You had to double down on minding us. Yeah, double down on creating an atmosphere that was less terrifying. And you had to, as you say, mobilise. I mean, this was like a military operation for you guys.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we did, and we mobilised very rapidly, but we got fully supported from all our colleagues within the HSE, the Department of Health, etc. Ambulance crews across the country, once it comes to do with patient care, right?
Yeah.
And doing a positive impact on a patient or doing something to help somebody, we will mobilise, right? So we did all the logistics plans, we did all the planning, we got all the equipment in, we got all the PPE, as you call it, the personal protective clothing in. Mm. We had to look at a new way of working, is correct, Ryan, very quickly, because, again, our crews were out there, along with other members of the HSE, etc., on the front line, meeting people, going into locations. A lot of people had left, but we were still going in, if you know what I mean, to do a swab or a test or whatever it was, or to treat a patient, because that's what it's about. People still get sick, still have car crashes, etc., and we would have to be able to treat them. And we needed to make sure that our crews were safe, that our crews were, I was probably confident in what they were doing that was safe, but also the patient was safe.
Yeah.
So we had to do a new way of working, which was donning and doffing of the PPE equipment, etc.
In my ignorance, I didn't realise how extraordinary the National Ambulance Service was. I'm just going to be straight with you, because I didn't have a first-hand experience of what you did until this all kicked off. And so much so that I really wanted to come in and meet you in your natural environment. That is to say, your office,
yeah.
And in Tala, which I don't know, when was that, a year ago?
Yeah,
or
so just a year ago.
Is
now,
it a year?
Stage, yeah,
it's just short of a year. Feels like a few months, but anyway. And I walked in there, and you know, met your team and friends and colleagues. I mean, it was like a James Bond lair of screens and buzzing and instruments and tools of learning, and there you are with your, you know, with your wall to wall full of commendations for the service, because you're a humble guy, you wouldn't be taking the credit that you deserve, but you know, for the service and how well regarded you are internationally as a service. I mean, you've a lot to be proud of.
Yeah, thanks very much, Ryan. Yeah, and I suppose like ambulance service, we're one of the funny emergency services, if you want to put it that way, because in the main, people don't really want us, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but the last thing people want to see is this big yellow
yoke. It's true,
But they actually know at that moment in time they need us. Right?
Gotcha.
And when we go out to someone like that, we want to make sure that every piece of the toolbox that's needed to make sure we can look after that patient. That's what it boils down to. We can take it all out, but that's what it boils down to. We can look after the patient. And whether it's from when they dial 11299 until that ambulance delivers them into a hospital, that we can give the best that we can give within what we have, right?
Yeah.
And every part of that is broken down, as you've seen yourself, into various modules. And we look at that and we make sure that we emphasise in relation to education, ability to be able to contact people and ability to be able to alert it, and that the crews have the equipment that they need to deliver the best care. And you are right, we're a national ambulance service and there's very few in the world, right? And that allows us to do things that other ambulance services can't. And it allowed us to mobilise even to the COVID thing very quickly because we're national. So everything is on a singular set of systems, on a singular screen, as you've seen,
yeah.
And we do everything in the same way. So in fairness, crews came up from Kerry up to Dublin, from Dublin up to Donegal, from Donegal down to Cavan. Whatever needed to be done, the crews are willing to do it. And they did it. And we can move that way, which gives us a huge amount of flexibility.
Yeah.
And it's very much part of the system. And across the world, that's recognised as a very positive way to do the job and deliver care, because we don't have boundaries.
You very kindly brought me around to meet your friends and colleagues and saw the ambulance simulator.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the CPR...
mannequins, is it?
Yeah. I didn't know what to call it. So it's a rigorous process. But I'm delighted that you allowed me to come in and see through the door, because, again, it put it all in my head and it allowed me to visualise it more. So thanks for that. I appreciate it.
No, Graham, it was greatly appreciated, because we speak ambulance speak a lot of the time, and I have a tendency of doing that, and I'm trying not to, but we have a tendency of doing that. And sometimes a picture speaks 1,000 words, and when you see the infrastructure that's there, it gives people an understanding of how it works, to make sure it works right.
Help us place your accent. Where are you from?
I'm placed in Trim, County Meath.
It's beautiful.
Capital town.
You're saying the right thing. But you didn't start off as an ambulance guy, did you?
No, I suppose my career was a bit varied from that, all right. I started off when I left school. I got a job in Roadstone and I trained as what you call a construction plant fitter. Diesel mechanic, petrol mechanic, fleet mechanic out in the quarries in Slane. and I did 4 years of that, and I got a qualification in City and Guilds called a construction plant.
Yes.
It's always stood to me, by the way. It's good to know how to tinker with an engine.
I envy you. So when did you hear, as you might say, the siren call?
Well, it was very interesting. Like everything else in those days, when you finish your apprenticeship, unfortunately, going back many, many, many years now, right, you were laid off by the wind. That's the way it was, right? And you went through ANCO or whatever it was at the time.
Yeah. I remember that too, yeah.
Maybe you did. I do, you see, you know yourself, so that's giving you an age. Yeah. But not you, me, I'm talking about. So then I was looking, I always wanted to be doing something, so I was doing bits of work in some garages around the town, and I got a job in a hospital in Trim called St. Joseph's Hospital in Trim, and it's still there to this day. Mm-hmm. And I was on the wards, right? Dealing with people, dealing with the patients, dealing with staff, just doing general ward duty, which I actually quite enjoy because I do like engaging with people and chatting away.
Convivial man, yes.
Yeah, and I ended up then outside doing some maintenance work out there because some of the work that was going on, part of my training suited what needed to be done at the time, and the matron at the time said, go ahead and give them a hand. So I was out there. Then I applied for a job in the... I met a couple of ambulance people coming in out of the hospital, and I always admired the way they were able to chat with the patient, relax the patient, you know, and move on. And I was in good form, in fairness, even if they were busy. So I said, I applied for the job, and that's...
And so it began. Did you nearly bail on day one? Is that true?
It was an interesting day one.
Okay.
Yeah, it was unpleasant in one way, to be honest with you. It was a baptism of fire. Really well protected by the people I was with. That's what I'm saying to you. The community, when something like that happens, I mean, I was the newbie. The first thing was a very serious road traffic collision. We won't get into it, but I mean, it was unpleasant. I couldn't even open a bandage on the scene at that stage, but I was looked after. I was third person on, if you know what I mean. Did another call directly after that, which was a fall from a horse, and another call directly after that was a cardiac arrest. And I said to them, you know, this is tough going, and that was my first day. But again, community gathered around you. Settled down, had a conversation, come back in tomorrow, get back on the bike, and off you go, you know, and I've been there since.
And you keep going. I mean, there's and the things you see, and the from human to dog, anything can happen. Isn't that, you know where I'm going with this, but anything can happen when you get a call.
Well, you can, and I know where you're going with this, right? Anything can happen. And as again, if you go back to it, like, I mean, in them old days, we were going out, I was going out in a white ambulance, right? Remember the good old white ambulances? Yeah. We used to have two tones, which was knee, gnaw. Sometimes you had the knee, you didn't even get the gnaw, whatever, right?
Hang on. What are you talking about?
Well, you know, the sergeant used to go, you have the Bebo or the knee, gnaw, and halfway up the road, it'd usually change from knee, gnaw to knee. So people going, what's coming down the road?
But is there anything to be read into the knees and the nose?
Well, just that they used to fill full of flies, you see, on the roof because there were kind of a funnel going the wrong way, so you'd lose out of it. So you'd lose half lose half your impact on arrival, you know, that sort of way.
I had this sort of like, it's a message to say that it's a much more serious case if it's only a knob, but if it's a knee, but actually it's flies in this iron. Okay, keep going.
But I mean, yeah, so like, I mean, the thing about it, we didn't even have defibrillators when I started first, you know, I mean, defibrillators were the size of the console you have in front of you then, so we couldn't get them into vehicles. But it was all still about treating the patient. And look, as we moved on, I mean, you treat as Paul O'Connell said once, you deal with the rock in front of your face if you can at all. So, like, I mean, we did have... And again, what you need to do is make sure that when you're dealing with the patient, who, as I said to you, doesn't really want you but really needs you, right?
Yes, for sure.
That you do all the little things that make the difference, right? And, I mean, ambulance crews are out there as we speak, and I've no doubt about it, either turning off the kettle, locking the windows, popping into the next door neighbour to say, can you look after this or can you look after that? And I mean, sometimes you might have to go a step further. I mean, I think you're probably referring to the one night we did a call, patient was an assault call. And in fairness, when we got there, the patient who was assaulted was thanks to God, relatively okay, if you know what I mean, but still needed to come in. But they had their dog with them, and their only companion in the rural area they were living that night was their dog, right? And the dog had just had a bad experience with people trying to give the man an assault, and he looked at us coming and he said, well, here's 2 more bucks now, I'll sort these lads out, you know. So he didn't welcome us with open arms, the dog, even though the patient was doing his best. So we had to work our way through.
Okay, through the canine anger.
Yes, correct. And in fairness, I'd say he'd done a good job with the other people who were there before we had arrived, in fairness to him.
Okay.
And the only way we could either get the patient into the ambulance or the patient into hospital was bring both, right?
Yeah.
And the colleague I was with at the time, in fairness, the art of delegation was, well, you need to go in and explain it, Martin, because you made the decision.
The art of delegation. So I like that.
I had to go in then and explain to the hospital staff that I have a patient in the back of the vehicle who's been assaulted, but I also have his dog, which in this day and age now wouldn't be probably accepted as well. But in fairness, a matron walked around the corner and said, what's about? And different days, dog was put into a special area within the casualty, given a bowl of water, and everyone was happy, right? And put it that way, including
the
patient.
The dog was fine. Joking, no.
Nobody knew us every for a while, and but it's that sort of thing you need to do, yeah, because that takes the worry. Like, people worry about little things.
Yeah, of course they do.
Sorry.
No, but you've also delivered a heap of babies. How many babies would you say?
Well, I've delivered personally in the back of the vehicle as well. Deliver is the wrong word too. I have assisted in the delivering, because let's be honest, it's the mother that does delivery. But I've assisted in delivery. I've done 12 myself, including a set of twins.
And twins as well.
Yeah, interesting call that too. Yeah, no one was expecting any, but we ended up with two.
You're deadly handy to have around the place, aren't you? I mean, if it's not for something under the bonnet, it's something something a little more intense than that.
Well, to be honest with you, as part of the ambulance service, people say to me on a regular basis, "What do you actually do?" Right?
They don't know, do they?
But you know what I mean. So, like, you can be a counsellor today, because what you have to do is connect with the patient, and you're in a location with people, as I said, who need you there but don't particularly want you. Yeah. And they're very scared. And you can see it in their eyes in a lot of cases. If an ambulance arrives, they know something's not right. So they're scared. They're very concerned. Their relatives, their loved ones are there in some cases. They're scared and relatively concerned. And here's two strangers, in fairness, walking in the door. And you can be entrusted with looking after that person's life, which is not, which is not a small task.
No, far from it. Nora says, "I'm listening while sitting at the kitchen table doing my physio after falling in January. But thank you so much to the ambulance service. I had to call, as I had no other option. I felt so guilty, but the ambulance staff were outstanding, as were the people in Connolly Hospital who treated me, are continuing to do so. 5 stars. I can't thank them enough." Another from Adele says, "I have nothing but praise and appreciation for the ambulance service. I have no doubt my father would not be alive today without them, and in particular their Pathfinder service, which is currently being trialled in North Dublin." Excellent. "An amazing service. I hope it's continued and rolled out to the rest of the country."
That's excellent. Yeah, that's an excellent service. Again, it's patient focus. It's about keeping people at home. It's under the Sláinte Care banner. Yeah. So we're trying to develop what we call community paramedics. So there's care in the community, and they respond to certain types of calls, and hopefully we can keep the patient at home, engage with the HSE, do assessments of the patient's environment, so we can, small changes that mean a lot, that means the patient can stay at home, have their dignity and respect at home, and be kept at home in a safe manner.
Makes sense.
Pathfinder works really well, yeah.
Martin, I'm bouncing back a little bit to when we spoke in Tala, and you were saying that you have 3 daughters, all of whom are teachers, and so they were kind of frontline of a sort too. And then you were coming home. And remind me, because they would always stay with me about going home at night, all of you, and the rule of the three wash baskets, and the washing machine. Tell people about that.
Well, again, it's back to, I suppose, basics in one way, Ryan. It's about protecting everyone else. So, I mean, including deliveries to the house at the time, you know what I mean? Because and that to come in needs to be left for a few hours, maybe up to 48 hours, left in an area that's safe, and it gives you a chance to keep it separated. So at the time, again, people weren't 100% sure what we were dealing with, but you're looking at infection control. So the best thing to do is make sure that you had an area set up that each person had that they could take off the unnecessary stuff, put it through the washing machine, make sure it's clean, and then hang it out. So everyone did their piece, With the girls, of course, you'd have a mirror involved as well, but that'd be fine, yourself.
And the last one in was the first one who had to do the wash.
Absolutely. That's the way it was.
There's a lot of pressure. I mean, they were all obviously all living at home, but that was just a COVID vignette, if you like.
Absolutely.
Why are you leaving? Why are you retiring?
Look, I suppose that there is, sometimes you say to yourself, it's just time to hang up the boots, Ryan.
Yeah.
I've a lot of years done. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Yeah.
The National Ambulance Service has been very good to me, as I've been very good to it, if you know what I mean. And, I think it's just time just for me to move on now and maybe let someone else come in and add more value.
I think in all the years I've interviewed somebody in a position of authority and responsibility, you're definitely up there in terms of people who just love what they do. I got the sense talking to you the last time, and I see it in your eyes today, that it'll be a big one for you to leave this behind, because you do look like somebody, like so many people get to the end of their careers and they're kind of angry or a little bit embittered or certainly bored or just exhausted. You look like there's another term of office in it for you if you wanted it. So is it a tough one for you?
Yeah, I suppose tough, Ryan, might be just the wrong answer, but it's a considered one, right? And it's part of, it was a family discussion as well, not just Martine going off and make up his own mind. I know my place at home as well, yourself. So we have the discussion about it. And again, I mean, Karina, I've left the table on Christmas Day to respond. I'm still a practicing paramedic, so whilst I am the director of service, we still respond to calls if and when you're needed, right? So I mean, they were so used to me disappearing maybe or not being there or coming home late, every other ambulance man that does the work, because that's what it's about. So, I mean, at this stage, I said, right, OK, I've done a good job, I hope, right?
You have,
Added a bit of value. good foundation there, so let someone else bring it on with them.
Good on you. I needed the ambulance service on a couple of occasions, says the text, and they are fabulous, kind, a little funny when needed, and very careful. Well done to them all. You're laughing at that because you know it's true. Grace says, we live at a busy junction and ambulances pass regularly. I used to bless myself and say, God, there's someone in trouble. My husband said one day, no, there's someone getting help. Which is a good attitude. Another says, great to listen to Martin. Well done. They're great people. My daughter is doing her leaving cert next year. She says that when she's finished her leaving, she wants to be a paramedic, and I hope she can be successful at it. So there's the next generation. And Martin Dunn, to you and to Karina and to Shauna and Aoife and Kira, every happiness in your retirement. You deserve nothing but the best. And as the saying goes, thank you for your service, because you have done the state some service, and I think they know it. And we appreciate you coming in. And I'd like to think that we're friends now, and I look forward to seeing you on the other side sometime soon.
Yeah, Ryan, listen, thanks very much. And if you don't mind, I'd just like to say thank you to everyone out there at this moment in time that's doing what they're doing on the front line. That's the National Ambulance Service and all their other colleagues through the whole of the HSE that are doing their job today and doing their job in tough times. And I'd like to say thanks for the support that I've got and the support we've got from the likes of yourselves, which makes our job a little bit easier.
You're gent. You. Martin Dunn, director, outgoing director of the National Ambulance Service. Good luck with it all and see you soon. I've been talking about a book that has me utterly absorbed, and it's an area of history that I haven't really taken any great interest in until this book landed on my desk. It's called Madhouse at the End of the Earth, the Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. Think of The Terror, that TV show with Ciarán Hinds. Think of Shackleton and Crean, and think of Adventure and Daring Do. The author, Julian Sancton, joins us now. And Julian.
Good morning, how are you?
Congratulations on your book. It's really a wonderful achievement. Delighted for you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Welcome to the show, by the way. I was intrigued to know that this all started in some respects with your interest in an article about a trip to Mars.
Yeah, so I was at my desk at Departures magazine at the time, and I was flipping through the pages of the New Yorker magazine, and there was an article about how NASA is planning on sending men and women to Mars, and they're studying the effects of confinement and isolation and extreme environments on the psychology of these astronauts. And the article began in unexpected fashion with a short summary of this expedition that I'd never heard about, the Belgica expedition. And in those three paragraphs, it evoked the image of people going insane near the South Pole. And that was just so gothic. It was just such a great detail. And then when I learned that one of the key factors in the survival of those who did survive was the presence of the American Dr. Frederick Cook, who was later maligned as a great fraudster, a guy who lied about being the first to reach the North Pole, lied about being the first to reach the summit of the tallest mountain in America, and was imprisoned for 7 years for running a Ponzi scheme, the kind of combination P.T. Barnum and Bernie Madoff. Mm. When I heard that that guy was the hero of this trip, then that was just so irresistible. I love a heroic anti-hero. Mm. And so, yeah, that's what I decided to learn more about.
Okay, so it must be so exciting. Let's assemble the cast of characters that would populate the Belgica, the boat.
Sure.
that took us into the dark, as you say, Antarctic night. This reads like it's almost like an Agatha Christie setup of everyone has an interest in this thing being successful as it happens. But what a cast of characters! And let's start, I suppose, with the man at top. This is de Gerlache himself.
Yes. So it was his idea. Adrien de Gerlache was a Belgian aristocrat, a young man, probably 26 when he came up with this crazy idea, and it was a absurd passion for a Belgian at that time to have any seafaring dreams, because it was a country with with no maritime tradition to speak of. They had no navy, a bare bones merchant marine, and any adventurer worth his salt at that time would have been more tempted to seek his fortune in the Congo. Mm. But de Gerlache had no appetite for colonialism, and he had his eye on colder horizons, and decided that he would heed the call of the World Geographic Societies, who at that time had decided that the exploration of the Antarctic, which was almost entirely unknown at that time, was of the utmost priority. And so he assembled, or rather scraped together, a ragtag group of what semi-qualified Belgian sailors he could find, a somewhat more reliable group of Norwegian sailors, and Eastern European scientists, and this aforementioned American doctor. A lot of his staffing decisions were questionable, but there were a few that certainly made the difference later on. Cook was one, and another was the first mate of the expedition, a Norwegian man named Roald Amundsen, who would later become something of a legend for having blazed through the Northwest Passage and beaten Robert Falcon Scott to the South Pole. And possibly, if what we know now is accurate, it's always questionable these achievements in polar regions, but possibly was the first of the North Pole. So for Roald Amundsen, the Belgica was a testing ground, an apprenticeship of sorts. And it's funny that the great legend of polar exploration should have learned so much from the great anti-hero, the great huckster of polar exploration, Frederick Cook. But he did. He revered him.
As I was reading about the cast of this particular adventure, Julian, I was thinking of it's like a Marvel, you know, crew. And if it was a Marvel crew, it would be Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, it is, and they all brought something to it. I think of it as one of those Men on a Mission movies, like the Dirty Dozen.
Yes. So, yeah.
And despite my education as a historian, I can't help make those cinematic comparisons either.
It is cinematic as an experience, as a read, and as a story. And as you say, once you hear Gothic, you know, we're going right back into that particular zone. Looking at them, even they have a great look. They're very young. They could fit into the East Village having beers in modern New York. Do you know what I mean? They look like hipsters.
They really do. I mean, they did. It helps that they let their beards grow. But later in the expedition, when the sun returns, the morale was so low that Frederick Cook decided that he needed to do something to keep spirits up, and so he gave everybody haircuts. And he had this habit of just cutting part of their hair and then letting them and refusing to cut the other side. So I'm sure they looked even more like East Village hipsters at that point.
Yeah, for sure. So many places to go. Let me just talk about how the anthropologist and the naturalist on board were. They're like children looking out the window, the porthole, go, stop here. I want to go over there. You know? And yet,
exactly.
the captain or the commandant was saying, stop asking. We have to get further. You're interrupting. And yet their curiosity is infectious right down through the passage of time for us now in 2021.
Yeah, absolutely. And those were two incompatible aims. From the beginning, de Gerlache wanted to frame this as a serious scientific expedition. But at the same time, he realized that in order to get the public behind him, he needed to promise some kind of exploit that would electrify the press and the public at large. And, you know, the discovery of the mating patterns of the Gentoo penguin probably wasn't going to do the trick. So he promised the attainment of the South Magnetic Pole, which at that time had not been located. And that's somewhat different from the South Geographic Pole. It's just with the center of magnetic activity in the South, in the polar regions. So whereas a thorough scientific expedition required that the scientists take as much time as they can, investigate every tide pool, every glacier, the attainment of a distant geographic goal required that they move as fast as possible. So those two aims ended up clashing and delayed the expedition. And by the time he set out for the geographic pole, it was far too late in the season, and the winter ice was setting in. And so he had a decision to make: do I come home empty-handed? Am I going to be able to show my face to my illustrious family and wonder what the Belgian press will make of this, or do I nevertheless pursue a relentless southern route, knowing full well that the ice will surround the ship and close in and possibly crush the ship? But if we do survive, we will be the first to endure the cruelties of an Antarctic winter. And that will be something we can crow about back home, because in exploration at that time, the real resource, the real goal was to have a great story to tell. And he certainly succeeded there.
You've set up this story in many ways that now people can read the rest for themselves. But in the way you describe them, there are many shadows cast on the characters of this ship. The shadows of fame, the shadows of shame, shadows of ambition, and that great big yawning shadow of legacy.
Yeah, yeah, and those were, everybody dealt with those in different ways. Mm. Dozier Lash was hamstrung by it. This fear of, it was as much a pursuit of glory as a fear of humiliation. But he was not, despite those dreams of glory, he was not himself a conqueror. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I found somewhat admirable about him. Yeah, even though he made this decision and lied to the men about his decision to get caught in the ice, he claimed it was an accident, and he claimed that they were actually making progress towards the north when they were making progress towards the south, which defies belief to me. But he was. You mentioned these shadows, and for me, that's something that really drew me to the men is the idea that nobody is the storybook version of themselves in these kind of adventure stories. They're all nuanced, like all of us. And for him, what I found the most appealing was that he was a pacifist. He was at a time when there was the world was caught in a jingoistic frenzy that would soon lead to war. He put together what I believe to be one of the first international scientific expeditions, laid the groundwork for a geopolitical miracle, which is the last 120 years of peace in the Antarctic, the only continent that has never seen war or poverty or genocide. He didn't, unlike anybody else in the or unlike most explorers, I should say, in the heroic age that followed, he didn't lay claim to any land. He didn't name a land after his king, which was expected of him. He was appalled by the Congo. So I think people who followed made different decisions, but the fact that he was just a model of international cooperation, and in fact a model that serves as an inspiration for both the International Space Station and hopefully for the aforementioned missions to Mars.
Mm. The biggest character, apart from the breathing human beings on the boat, in your magnificent book is nature. And there is an expression in America that has followed us across the Atlantic, which is awesome. It's awesome. And I say that with this cynical, dry skepticism with which I just pronounced it. But, like that coffee's awesome. It's not. I'll tell you what's awesome is nature in the Antarctic. And
that is the perfect word for it.
Isn't it just? And, and even to the point where they start having illusions like a mirage in the desert. You can have that, and suddenly the ice formations become a city or a bridge because they're going mad. I mean, that's the name of the book. And nature's presence in this book is, like, I felt completely reconnected to my respect for nature because of how big it is.
It was a maddening environment. It was nature, especially down there, is a trickster, and not only the landscape, which was made entirely of water. It was one of the men said, it was a parody of terra firma. It looked like a desert. It looked like you could trust every step, and looked like there were mesas and mountains in the distance, as reliable as nearby towns. But it was in constant flux. Every step could have been a light covering of snow over a hole a patch of slush, and if you stepped on it, you would almost certainly die. You sink beneath the pack and die of hypothermia or drown. And the light as well played tricks. There were things that we've never seen outside of polar environments. Fog bows, parhelic circles, sun dogs. You mentioned the beautiful southern lights, which were mesmerizing, and then you mentioned the mirages. There's such a thing as a Fata Morgana, which is a particularly awesome, to use your word, mirage, where distant objects seem to float over the horizon, or to be greatly extended or distorted or inverted. And indeed, in de Jorlach's log, which I was lucky enough to access, he describes this in the most. He's one of the most remote humans in the world at that point, and yet he describes what he sees in the distance as a city by the sea, with a complete with a lighthouse shining towards him. So, you know, these were they couldn't believe their eyes, and it was they couldn't trust their eyes, rather. And so that definitely set the stage for a descent into madness as the sun disappeared for months.
The other aspect of nature that really struck me was the ferocity and the power and the cruelty of wind.
Yeah. It's you know, there's only two forces that affect the pack ice, and it's the same two forces that affect water. It's the current and the wind. And to think that those two things were responsible for all their suffering, for not only the incessant howling in the rigging, but also for the pressure of the ice, which is moved primarily by wind and current, and that the ship was at the mercy of these things, and especially of wind, something that can't even be touched or seen. That the wind should threaten them every day with destruction, I found also pretty gothic.
Gothic, but also you were able to write noise. I could hear the wind in your book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, one of the things that I really insisted on doing, although I didn't go as far as I could have, was to go to Antarctica.
Oh, wow.
Myself. And a lot of the sights and sounds and even smells are things that I didn't feel like I could rely on the diaries and firsthand accounts to recreate. So the wind is definitely, you know, we've all heard wind, but down there it's particularly strong and maddening. And so that was something that I'm glad I was able to go down there to fill out those details. And you know, another thing that surprised me about that, it was if I was relying simply on the photos of Frederick Cook, and they were the first ever taken of the Antarctic, by the way, and they're sublime.
Yes.
But I would have been, if I had just been relying on them, I would have been describing a landscape in black and white, and it certainly wasn't that. I mean, I was struck by the vivid colors of the ice and the whole range of blues and even greens and yellows that the ice can take on.
The history nerd in me is absolutely bowled over by the wealth of kind of prima facie evidence, if you like, that you could pull together to produce this book. I mean, right down to the log books from de Jorlach's that you had the pleasure of meeting his great-grandson. And obviously, they were very prolific diary keepers on this boat,
yeah,
as well. I mean, this was these guys were very history friendly.
They really were. I mean, I thought that one of the reasons this story hadn't been properly told before was because there was not much of a historical record. And boy, was I wrong about that. Of the 19 men who left South America for Antarctica, about a dozen kept some kind of detailed record. And I was lucky enough to find a lot of them. I mean, the one that eluded me, which I'd be desperate to take a look at, although it's impossible, was that of one of the men who lost his mind and never recovered. Mm. When the ship got back with slightly fewer men to Punta Arenas, the men decided that they would burn his. He fled into the woods. And then they decided that they would burn his diary rather than let posterity see the horrors it contained.
Hence, all, of course, all of the madness. We have two great explorers in the Irish history books here, of course, Ernest Shackleton and Tom Crean. I
yes.
don't know if you've come across them in your studies, Julian.
I have. And in fact, the Endurance,
yeah.
Shackleton's famous ship, was built for none other than Adrien de Jorlach. It was something of a sister ship to the Belgica. It was built in the I believe by the same shipbuilder, and it was originally destined to de Jorlach, but he had run into financial trouble and then called up his good friend Ernest Shackleton and said, "Hey, do you need a ship?"
That's amazing.
And the rest was history.
That is absolutely amazing. And you know, your book reminded me of something that I think that, you know, my parents' generation probably read as adventure stories made up back in the day. But of course, you know what? Yours is nonfiction. It just feels, it feels so old fashioned in the most glorious way.
Well, you know, I wrote the kind of book that I wanted to read, and I think one of the models for this was Alfred Lansing's Endurance, which told the Shackleton story so brilliantly, and it was written decades ago, and it was a model of how to do nonfiction in a novelistic way without sacrificing the seriousness of it, and so that's something I really strove to do. These stories that you mentioned, that they were all prolific writers, they were, and the reason is they were romantics. Even the scientists, when you read their writing, it reads like a polar horror story. Even the naturalist, even the geologist, they were influenced as much by Jules Verne and Edgar Allan Poe as they were by their colleagues and fellow scientists. One of the reasons that I was able to kind of achieve that effect and create that atmosphere is because they did. Their descriptions are vivid, colorful, spooky, you know, what have you. All the range of emotions that great writing can summon were summoned in their diaries. So, that definitely aided my task.
Well, you channeled their writing and I think their mindset just spectacularly well. In your book, Julian, thank you so much for being with us this morning, and indeed for the book. You've opened my mind to a whole new world. I'm excited to read more and more, but what a great start. Congratulations and thanks for your time today. Wish you well.
Thanks so much, Ryan. It was a pleasure.
Likewise. Okay, Julian Sancton joining us. He is the author of that wonderful book, beautiful and brilliant. It's called Madhouse at the End of the Earth, the Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. And like I say, I don't think you have to be a sailor. I don't think you have to be a history buff. I just think you need to be interested in humans to enjoy that, and indeed nature. The text number, as always this morning, is 51551.